Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to Inside Scoop Live, the live audio program brought to you by ReaderViews.com. I'm your host, Juanita Watson, and today I have the pleasure of talking with author Frank McGee about his new book, A Song for the World, the amazing story of the Colwell brothers and Herb Allen. Frank has pulled from hundreds of letters, documents, and interviews, as well as his five-decade friendship with the Colwell brothers and Herb Allen, to bring to light this fascinating and little-known piece of history. So a little bit about this author. Frank McGee has built a distinguished career as a writer and journalist over half a century. In the tumultuous 1960s, he covered stories as far afield as Brazil, Indonesia, and Vietnam. As managing editor of Pace magazine, a contemporary of Life, Look, and Holiday, he worked with thought leaders from around the world. During the 1970s, McGee launched and edited New Worlds, the signature magazine of California's Orange Coast, and the University of California at Irvine tapped him to write the coffee table book commemorating the school's first 25 years. In the 1980s and 90s, he authored and edited books on a variety of topics that were published in dozens of languages. And today, Frank lives with his wife in Tucson, Arizona. So I'm so happy to have Frank on the phone today. Welcome to Inside Scoop Live, Frank.
Well, I'm very glad to be here, Juanita.
Well, great. So would you start by telling us, you know, I know a lot of people are probably not necessarily familiar with the Colwell brothers and Herb Allen and the Up for People phenomenon. So would you tell us a little about the early beginnings of both the Colwell brothers and Herb Allen? And because I understand that they didn't enter the music industry together. How did they get their starts?
Well, they were phenomenons in their teens, really. Well, Herb Allen was considered a prodigy from his childhood. At age four, he was conducting the Seattle Baby Orchestra.
Was he really?
Yes.
What year was that?
Mm-hmm. Oops, I don't know. That
around.
Was anyway, it was a while ago.
Okay.
He's just about, believe it or not, in this next 2 weeks from now, he's going to be at his 60th high school reunion in Seattle, and he's been all over the world ever since, and there are going to be 100 people at that event because they can't believe what has happened to this guy. That's Herb Allen. He is a xylophone master, and from his age of, say, 5 to 15, he was weekly on the radio in Seattle with a new piece every week. You think of how many songs that number totes up to. In his high school year, he had dance band, but he studied classical piano under the best teachers. But he got caught by something. His music could do something in the world that was very important, and that's what happened in his teens. The Colwell brothers started. Also very early on, they formed a band in the three brothers, Steve, Paul, and Ralph, when I think Ralph was 10, and they were urban bluegrass country group, and probably the first one, I hesitate to say always the only one, but They lived in California. They lived in they were born in Detroit. Mm. They entered the very famous hillbilly bluegrass music contest in Kentucky, and they won it as kids. And
wow.
Columbia Records signed them when they went back to California. They were the youngest trio under contract group under contract with a major label.
Oh, is that right?
And they broadcast still in their teens, weekly on NBC television with the Tex Williams show that broadcast from Knott's Berry Farm. That was the first, amusement park in the country. It
mm-hmm.
was before Disneyland,
mm-hmm.
and they anyway they in their teens they turned to public service. They and Herb Allen, they met a group called Moral Rearmament that was involved in international aviation and development of leadership, and they decided they were going to use music, and they took off, in a sense, turned away from careers and what they were going for, and for the next 40 years, they made a lot of history. They worked in 60 countries. The Caldwell brothers ended up singing in 37 languages and dialects. Actually, the book says 37, but in the last since the book has been published, they've discovered some old documents from their travels, and they actually, the number is up to 41 languages and dialects.
Oh, isn't that something?
And still counting.
Oh, that's incredible. So how was your research process of compiling all of this information? I mean, that must have been overwhelming for you.
Well, it would have been, but I was very lucky because they all sent, their families were participating in what they were doing, so they all sent letters home. And their families kept the letters, and they sent pictures, and so I had a wealth of hundreds of letters to find the stories of what they. There's a lot of sacrifice involved in this because they were not just there to be playing music, but they were connecting people. They were singing in the Japanese Diet. The first people ever did something like that. They sang to kings and queens, and in the huts of African villagers, and then people started sending me, when they heard that we were going to do this book, they started sending me pictures that they had sort of squirreled away from important events in different parts of the world. So the book is very picture rich all the way through. It's a graphic look at what they did as well as in the story.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, I've often thought if people didn't know this was a true story, they'd think it was made up because nobody has ever done anything like what these four. Well, one thing they did, of course, and this is what their many people consider their legacy in the 60s. They were the musical founders of this phenomenon called Up With People, which, over the years it had 20,000 people in different Up With People cast companies and all over the world. And there are casts right now in Asia and Europe. And so they had quite a story.
So they actually founded Up With People. I didn't realize that.
Yes, they were the musical founders of Up With People, and it began, Up With People began without even meaning to begin, you might say, at a conference for young leadership in the Great Lakes. There were many young people there who, at the time, this was in the 60s, when young people were really wanting to be able to feel that they had a say in what was going to happen in the future. There was a lot of strife and a lot of protests and a lot of everything, but they said and they wanted to use their music for it. So the Caldwells and Herb set up a kind of a framework with others. Started out as a hootenanny, and then they created a showboat on a barge and toured some of the cities in the Great Lakes and gave a show, and then that morphed very quickly into the show Up With People, and it took off like a rocket, and within a year it was in all over the world in Asia, and there were groups that were with the concept of local sing-outs, they called them. There were about 60,000 young people involved in that in 16 countries all of a sudden.
You know, it seems so huge, but why haven't we heard, or maybe, I don't know, why wasn't this more mainstream? You know, this is really the first time your book, that was the first time I had heard of the Caldwells or Herb Allen.
I know, and I said to somebody once, this is probably, these are probably the most famous people you've never heard of.
It's true.
Take, for instance, the Super Bowl halftime show.
Mm-hmm. I was astounded by this. Yes,
tell us. They In 1976, Up With People had been, it was all over the world and singing in the White House and for the popes and for all kinds of people. And in 1976, the National Football League asked them to do the halftime show. They wanted something completely different because it was America's bicentennial year. They wanted something very different than the sort of marching band they'd always had in the halftime. So the Caldwells and other people in Up With People, they created a show format. And it's a very kind of exciting story in the book. The first chapter of the book is about this event. They literally invented the halftime show format for the Super Bowl. And they returned three times. They appeared four times in Super Bowls. I don't think anybody has done anything like that. Four different Super Bowls.
Yeah.
And then with TV audiences of 90 million around the world. So they're more famous maybe in some other places even than they are here. A lot of people have heard of somebody, well, I had a friend who sort of was in an Up With People cast or wanted to go or something. Well, there were 20,000 people actually did, and they're in very interesting positions today in business and industry and in entertainment and television and media. It's quite a story, and there's much more I'll just mention one thing.
Sure.
In the appendix of the book, there's a little kind of item which I kind of like, and it was circulated at an Up With People reunion. They have reunions every year from different people and come from different places. And
mm-hmm.
But at this reunion 2 years ago, it's called the Amazing Music History Quiz, and it asks about 30 questions or something. Did you know, who was the 20th century's youngest performing percussionist and all that stuff? Who
mm-hmm.
who played in the most venues internationally of their generation? Who introduced the Caribbean steel bands to North America? Well, that was Herb Allen.
Really?
And who created with others the second longest running musical of the 20th century? That's Up With People. It's run for 40 years. It's still going. Anyway, there's in that 1 year of the Super Bowl, the cast, there were five different cast companies, and they concentrated on the U.S. because it was America's bicentennial year, and they performed in 771 towns and cities in the United States in that year.
Wow.
For that show. For live audiences of, I think, 3.9 million or something.
Wow, and how is that possible? They were...
Well, it was before your time, Juanita.
Yeah, yes.
And the way they did this Super Bowl show, because they didn't ever have a chance to get everybody together, a brilliant choreographer was working with them, and... They set up, they sort of made it like a puzzle and with parts that a cast could learn and practice in a snowstorm in Illinois, in Montana or somewhere. And then they would come together after, just before the Super Bowl, they'd go to Florida where it was going to be in the Orange Bowl. And then they would put all these little pieces together into one big puzzle. And that's how they did the show, and it was just stood the place on its ear, believe me. It's quite an interesting first chapter, if I do say so.
Absolutely. So the front cover of your book has a statement, and it reads, "How vision, creativity, and commitment spark the Up With People phenomenon." So I'd like you maybe to talk a little towards that vision, creativity, and commitment. You know, you touched on it a little bit earlier, but what was this passion for change that they had, and what was really happening at that time that change was so desperately needed? You know, I know it was the 60s, but what was the inspiration, and where did that passion come from for the Caldwells and for Herb Allen?
Well, that is a very, very good question, and I think that's probably why they made such a difference, because I think they realized, and through the people they were working with, that if you're ever going to make a difference in the world, somebody's going to have to become different.
Mm.
And today, our politics and everything else, you know, we're all talking about who else needs to become different.
Mm-hmm.
And it is such a powerful statement that if you start with yourself, you know, something can happen. And so they made the hard decisions that they were going to use their creativity and their lives to bring people together to kind of build a better world. And that's all told in the book, which is a little bit hard to tell in a short time. But
sure,
that is, for instance, before Up With People began, they had been more than a decade in many of the hot spots of the world. In Japan, for instance, when Prime Minister Kishi in 1957 set out on an historic journey to all the nations that Japan had fought against in the Pacific to apologize for atrocities that happened during the war. The send-off for that event was with the Caldwell brothers and the friends they were working with there in his official residence. And the last thing that he saw when he left for the airport for that really historic trip was these three young Americans in cowboy costumes singing to him in Japanese in his own language on his own porch with the song they'd written especially for them about what Japan could be, the lighthouse of Asia. And you know, they've never gone anywhere to tell anybody what they ought to do, but to listen and to learn and to understand and to appreciate instead of compare. You know, there are some NGOs work on that basis, but what if, as a policy, diplomats worked on that basis? That would make a huge difference in the world. But that came from inside them, you know. It wasn't something that they were trying to tell anybody else they had to do.
Mm-hmm. This was a spark inside them. And I love the way you call them musical diplomats.
They are. And we got I just talked the other day with one of the men who was involved in the founding of the United Nations, and he said he wrote a testimony toward them, for them. It's in the book. He said they richly deserve the title of musical diplomats.
Mm-hmm. Yes, most definitely. So, Frank, what do you think it is about music that really has the ability to bridge differences and unite people? I mean, this is a common theme, and it's just so strong with the Caldwells and Herb Allen and their story. What do you think it is about music?
Well, you know, if I tell some people, ask me what this book is about, and right away I say, this is really about the power of music, and everybody nods their head.
Yes.
Because if I don't have to explain a thing, because everybody feels it, and everybody, whether they're a musician or not,
mm-hmm.
there's a quote in the everybody says music is our universal language, which is true.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a quote in the front of the book which I discovered from a book somebody sent me, and it's from an English educator, a famous headmaster, and 150 years ago, 1862, I think. And he said, and he was very forward-thinking in the fact that he said everybody can learn in class and races and all that. It was very class-oriented in those days. But he said, music is the only thing which all nations, all races, and both sexes can do equally well.
Mm.
And it is sooner or later the great world bond.
Mm.
And that probably describes it better than I can.
Oh, that's beautiful. That's beautiful. Is there music available today?
Yes. there is music available through some music is going to be available on through our book website. There's also music available through upwithpeople.org.
Okay.
That's the music that the Up With People cast has produced. They've produced many, many albums, many over in Britain with some of the leading producers and arrangers. Dave Mackay, a famous British musician. He's actually Australia-born, but he's worked with the Caldwell Brothers and Herb for many years producing albums, and he's the one who got, I don't know what's the equivalent in Britain for the Emmy, for the arrangement for that wonderful song, I'd Like to Teach the World to Sing.
Mm-hmm, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And my man who was, I think, the composer or arranger of St. Elmo's Fire, people like that they've been working with. And in the Congo, well, there's going to be more and more music available because one of the versions of the book comes with three CDs, actually. But they're not sort of fully into production yet because we're just kind of launching this swing with the book because it only really came out this year.
Mm.
But the in the Congo they worked in their compositions with some of the leading musicians in the Congo. In the Congo, that's a whole other story. They were there for. I'm not answering your question about music being available, but
that's okay.
They were there for the Caldwell brothers were there for a full year when the Congo became independent.
Oh, wow.
And they lived through revolution and military takeover, and Prime Minister Lumumba was killed, and it was a traumatic year. And they worked with a group of international volunteers who had the same commitment that they did. They were working with MRA, Moral Rearmament, the organization then. But they had a touch with everybody. Literally, they went to every province in the country, which is bigger, is the size of Western Europe.
Mm.
And they did 400 plus radio broadcasts on Radio Congo during that year. And that's the only communication, national communication, that there was. It's the equivalent of jungle drum and radio and television and everything, because that was what there was.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's an amazing chapter in the book. And sometimes they had to, when they were traveling, they had to put their van on a ferry that was made to cross the swollen river in the flood time. The ferry was made of planks laid on top of dugout canoes, and they'd pull themselves over on rope across these rivers.
Isn't that something?
There are pictures of that.
Oh, my gosh. Wow, that is incredible. So they really did witness history in the making in several countries.
Very, very much so. I think they probably worked in 60, I don't know how many countries, really.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Is there any kind of... do you think that this information, their story, their music coming to light once again, your book, do you think that's all due to the fact that we're somewhat in such a tumultuous time politically? Maybe we need a revival of this kind of a sentiment and this kind of a message?
That's a very good thought. There's some of the words of their songs, they just resonate. They're intensely relevant, and even though they were written typically for events or occasions, but there's one song that kind of strikes me about that, because it's called "Where the Roads Come Together." It was actually written in 1971 by Paul Caldwell.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the words are kind of recent.
Yes, please do.
It's none of us is born the same. We don't know why, it's the way we came. Every heart beats a little differently. Each soul is free to find its way like a river that winds its way to the sea. There are many roads to go, and they go by many names. They don't all go the same way, but they get there all the same. And I have a feeling that we'll meet someday where the roads come together up the way.
Mm. Beautiful.
That's a great song. And then there's another one that I think of that is was written at the time of the Bosnia crisis. And there was a PBS special one time of a bridge between the Serbs and the Bosnians, and it was sort of no man's land. And there was a story on a PBS special about a couple that had been killed trying to escape across it, and they wrote a song about that, which is one of the most moving songs I ever heard.
Oh, wow.
But the power of songs, for instance, in Mexico in 1977, I think, casts were touring all through Latin America, and in the president of Mexico asked them to do a special performance in the presidential palace, and one of the songs that had been written by Paul Colwell there, Paul Colwell is the sort of was the chief songwriter all through that time.
Okay.
And Pablo Casal called him, these are Casal's words, not mine, the famous cellist, a precious genius when he, what he is able to do with music.
Mm.
But the song that he wrote there so moved the wife of a former president who was in the audience. She said, "You've got to go to China, believe it or not. We're in Mexico City now." She said, "You got to go to China."
Mm-hmm.
Well, she had connections with the Chinese embassy. This is when there was no diplomatic relations between the U.S. and China.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think Nixon, I don't know if he'd taken his ping pong trip there or whatever, but and that first short visit that he made. But it all happened that by the next year, a cast went to China. They were the first performers to visit China after the Cultural Revolution, Mao Zedong's, the Gang of Four and all this sort of thing. And they were, and again, it was a song that it was written, Paul Colwell and others, with Herb Allen, had written this amazing song with somebody who spoke Chinese about our friendship deep and wide as the Yangtze River, which is the sort of symbol of unity in China, and it opened the whole country up. And then they did the same thing in the Soviet Union. They were there before the Berlin Wall came down, the first international performing group, and they went back four times.
Wow.
Quite a history.
No kidding. So Up With People is still going strong. Would you talk a little towards that and what the Colwells and Herb Allen's involvement is today?
Very much so. They're sort of senior persons, you might say.
Sure.
But there was an alumni reunion of Up With People in Tucson, where I live.
Mm-hmm.
And that used to be the headquarters of Up With People. And so a lot of people come here. And there was 1,200, 1,300 people at this reunion last month. And there was a guest appearance from the Colwells and Herb. And, oh, man, there was a big, big crowd at this event. And plus the public came to that.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're doing some of this. They're going to be at another, by the way, at that particular event, one of the persons in the audience was the grandson of Mahatma Gandhi, Raj Mohan Gandhi. And there's a chapter in the book about him, because they worked with him very closely, the Herb Allen and the Colwells,
mm-hmm.
but especially the Colwells in a time in India when they'd been with the president of India, and then they got a call to go to the south of India with Raj Mohan to walk from village to village with a Indian saint named Vinoba Bhave.
Mm-hmm.
He was Gandhi's disciple, and he sort of carried the mantle of Gandhi afterward. And he was collecting land for landless peasants in India voluntarily from people. And so the story is an amazing chapter. Went through this 115 degree heat in old 1937 Plymouth to get down to where they was going to be, and then they found them. And they he speaks Marathi, which is the language of that particular part of South India. On their way down there on a train to get to Pune and Bombay and all, they met in a station a member of parliament who is a friend of Rajmohan Gandhi, who is sort of hosting them there. And this man was from the untouchable caste.
Mm.
The untouchables were at one time, you know the stories. And he helped them put into the Marathi language a song that they wanted to sing called There's Enough Land in the World for Everyone's Need, but Not for Everyone's Greed.
Mm.
And,
wow.
And they learned, they put this into song, into Marathi in this train station in Bombay, I think it was, or Pune, somewhere, and learned it on the way down and in the car, and when they met with the saint finally, caught, after going through all this 12-hour ride or something on this old car, Vinoba Bhavi said, "What would you like to say?" And Kalwa said, "Well, we'd like to sing."
Mm-hmm.
So then they sang this song to him, and he was very struck by it.
Mm.
And he used it, and then he went out and addressed 10,000 people, and he used this song as his text, and then he taught it to all his people, and then they walked overnight. They slept with them in this village, and then they walked at 4 o'clock the next morning to the adjacent village, where the village is all lined up. You can imagine the picture. And
oh yes,
and it was quite a tale.
Oh,
anyway,
there's
more than you can imagine.
And you have that story in the book, obviously.
It's in the book. It's a very kind of engaging chapter.
Mm-hmm. Very.
I'm kind
very
of high on the book.
Yes, absolutely. Well, you should be. So I understand that you've been a friend of the Colwells for many years. I'd like you to tell us a little bit about your friendship and how it developed, and as well, I guess that kind of ties into my next question on why you decided to write a song for the world.
Okay. I actually met Herb Allen. I was working with Moral Rearmament in their theatrical productions. And I met Herb Allen backstage at a play in, hold your breath, 1945. and he was a junior in high school, and I wasn't much beyond it. And that's how I first met him. And then in 1952, the Colwells were given a tickets by a friend to a musical show, which was in the Hollywood premiere of a musical, and I happened to have been in that cast, and that's how I met them, and okay. So we've been friends ever since, and we've worked together in different parts of the world, in Italy, and Herb Allen one time, when he was working in the industrial areas of Italy, he got to know the workers in the management. He was staying with a communist family, and found a machine gun under his bed one night, and they said, "Well, everyone's got one in this apartment.
Oh,
not to
geez.
Worry.
Oh, God.
It's quite a lie." But then what was your second question now?
Well, why did you decide to write
book? Well, in 2003, we were getting together with some long-term friends, and one person who was, she's a lawyer from, prosecuting attorney from Oakland, California. She's talking about some of the terrible things that young people were facing in her town, city.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, "You know, there really ought to be a book about the Colwells and Herb." And the spark jumped at that point.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't realize then, to be honest, I didn't know how tremendous a story it was. I knew it was one of a kind, but I didn't know how profound and what the how far-reaching the implications were.
Mm-hmm.
So as it all developed, I've been working really, really hard, Juanita, to keep any spin out of it, because the more I found out about these guys, and the more I got higher on what they're have accomplished, but they don't make any claims, and so I figured I don't make any claims, and the facts speak for themselves in the book. But it's a lot of people say it's a good read, and it's It's like an adventure story.
Mm-hmm. Well, the purity of the message and the passion that they carried through what they did, I think you really did a great job of showing that in your book. So well done, well done.
Well, thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. So what do you think, we're kind of coming to a close here, Frank, but what do you think were Herb Allen and the Colwell brothers, what do you think their greatest contribution was over their long, long history? Or maybe their greatest hasn't happened yet. I don't know if they're still going.
It's still happening. Actually, next 2 weeks from now, they're going to be doing a book. They're in the middle of a book tour right now. They're going to be in Seattle with several events for public and for alumni and for in Spokane, Coeur d'Alene, Idaho. So they're still very much involved, though they all have their families and living different places. I think their great contribution, Juanita, is that everybody can make a difference if they want to. And they don't have to be a musician. They don't have to. Both my sons traveled with people at different times. And one of them, some friends said, well, I didn't know Hunter was a singer and a dancer. Well, he isn't. But he had a lot to do, because there's a lot to do with taking a program like that out there. And if somebody does want to make a difference, there are places, there are avenues where everybody can place that interest. And for instance, at the Up With People's shows today, when a cast goes into a city, they work for a week. The young people work for a week with the volunteer organizations in that city. They get to know the city. They work with maybe some local performing groups as well. And then when they do a show at the end of the week, all the revenue from that show goes to the local nonprofits.
Mm, wow.
So they're financed by sponsors and by what the students have raised for their own tour expenses.
Mm-hmm.
But it's and the whole point is to get people involved in their communities, and so that's a huge contribution, and I think that it's ongoing.
Absolutely. Now, I understand that you are doing a book signing. You're ready to hit the road here. We're in the beginning of September 2007. Would you tell us a little bit about where you're going? You just mentioned that the Colwells will somewhat be involved at one point of that journey.
Right. We have been in Santa Barbara, California, and in Pasadena. Pasadena was interesting because the Columbia Records gave them a big a plaque, and the president of the Grammys sent a big tribute, and they've had a lot of these things. But their purpose now is to get people to find out about the story and in Vashon Island in Washington, and an alumni event in Washington, they're just coming up 2 weeks from now. And then there will be other cities scheduled. I mean, there are four or five of them talking about it. There's going to be some information on the website if people have an interest to see whether, something could be arranged in their own city. But the bookstore signings, at the Borders bookstore in Santa Barbara, they said they hadn't ever had a crowd like that since Oprah.
Oh, my gosh. Wow. Wow. No, you will be in the Seattle area?
Yes, so. We'll be in the Seattle area, and there will be some information about that on our website. It'll be somewhat in the media up there. On Vashon Island, there's a benefit show with local youth chorus from the island,
mm-hmm.
And there's a public show in Coeur d'Alene, Idaho, and in Spokane.
Okay. And all that information, as you say, is on your website?
Yes.
And your website, once again, is?
asongfortheworld.com.
Great.
www.asongfortheworld.com.
Mm-hmm. It's a very, very nice website, and you have the book cover that comes right up on your front page, and it's just a
right.
wonderful, wonderful picture. So if that's any indication for readers, you know, the picture quality that is inside your book, then there you go. Very good.
And here's the funny thing about that cover picture. That picture surfaced in an archive of pictures that the Caldwell's mother had.
Oh.
And we have searched for 3 years to find out who took the picture.
Oh, wow.
And that's the only picture that we haven't been able to give a photo credit for. So if anybody finds out, let me know.
Anyone out there listening, well, there you go. It's a bit of a mystery. How fascinating.
Yeah.
Great. Well, Frank, it has been just great talking with you today. And
I enjoyed it very much.
Great. Do you have any final thoughts you'd like to share? We're kind of at the end here.
Final thoughts.
Mm-hmm. Any final thoughts you have today for listeners?
Well, I think that there's a power in music, and there's a power in everybody, and personally, I have been, if I may use the word, blessed to be part of this telling of this story for the last 3 or 4 years, because I think it's probably one of the more, probably the most important thing that I've ever written. I've been in writing a long time. Started out as a photojournalist, then I got into writing. But I'm very, very glad to be part of it and humbled.
It sounds like such a blessing. I love that you use that word. So we thank you so much for your time today, and congratulations on such a wonderful book, and much success to you. All right.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. There you go, listeners. I really, really strongly suggest that you check out A Song for the World. This is a wonderful, wonderful book with a message that we really all need to revisit. The website, once again, is asongfortheworld.com, and you can purchase this book through the website as well as local and online booksellers. And if you are in the Pacific Northwest, why not check out one of the book signings or the concert that Frank was talking to you about, and that more information can be found at his website. For a recent book review and online interview, go to readerviews.com, where we've posted that as well as some other information on Frank and A Song for the World. So anyway, thanks so much for listening to Inside Scoop Live today. I'm Juanita Watson, and until next time.